Okay, tonight's class, senior fellowship, when should a woman ask out a man? We start with a little video from none other than a sage in his own right, the sage that dominates the stage, Steve Harvey. Here we go.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So recently I turned 24 and I've come to the realization that I haven't been on a real date before. And as in real date, I mean being picked up, being courted. And I've noticed in my generation, men my age kind of just like to hang out and chill. They don't really like to schedule a time where we get together and actually go out to eat. And recently I started liking this guy and I know he likes me back, but he hasn't asked me out on a date. So how do I approach that conversation without seeming pushy or scaring him away?
Well, ladies, look, it's not being pushy. Here's the deal. Young guys now do it the way they do it because you allow them to do it this way. It's really, really that simple. I'm not knocking millennials at all. All my kids are millennials.
Yeah.
Because you're really the brightest group of people that have come along in a long time. You all are absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
You just gotta, it's a couple of things you all missed because you're so advanced in technology.
Yeah.
And dating is still boy meets girl. That don't change. You gotta look in somebody's eyes and you gotta feel something. You can't text that. So what you gotta do is you have to require that. It's a requirement that he want to take you somewhere. You can't just come over to my house and Netflix and chill. That ain't why you're so late. You have to get out and ring my doorbell.
Yes.
You have to come. You have to meet my dad. You can't blow your horn at my house. Toot, toot. It's really some stuff that's really cool to have that I was very fortunate to teach all four of my daughters. I've had young boys come through that gate and park their car and sit there waiting on them to come out the house. My daughter's not coming out that house. You're going to get your ass up out that car. You're going to ring this doorbell, and you're going to come meet me, partner. You got to come meet me. Now, if you don't ring that doorbell and come meet me, she never coming out there. You can text her all you want. I'm out here. You bet not. You bet not answer that phone. She go out to that car door. He don't get out that car. She stand right by that door. Men, we will do anything to get one of you. If you the one we want, it ain't nothing we won't do. You want me to open the door? Okay. You want me to pull out the chair? Okay. Oh, you want me to ring doorbell? I'm ready. You want me to cut my hair? I'm cut hair. My wife said, stop dying your mustache. Just go on and be distinguished. Let your wisdom and age show. Guess what? I come out here just like this. And don't matter what y'all say. Thank y'all. We'll be right back. Hey, you made it to the end of this video. I got...
All right. How do you know how to smile your face without Steve Harvey? I mean, this is it. All right. All right, here we go. Let me just... All right. All right, so let's do a little share screen. Question time. Well, I'll just read out the questions. Who should be the one to initiate a date according to Steve Harvey and why? If you're watching the video, who should be the one who initiates the date according to Steve Harvey and why?
The guy.
The guy. Why?
Let's go tradition, the guy.
Yes, well... Now, why is he positing that?
Because then the girls will then definitely put themselves in the position of having to ask out the guy if they allow them to not have to ask them out.
So what is it? What's his assumption, or what's his worldview that views that that's the situation, that's the appropriate circumstance? I'm not saying it is the. I'm just saying according to him. Let's just he's taking a traditional stance.
It seems that he's right, like taking a traditional stance, like that's the way it's been done. The millennial generation is being lax, and so that's like women are accepting less than they should. But I think like the problem with this whole his advice is that it assumes that everyone's going to listen to him.
Correct, but his argument is it's intrinsic. The way of the world is that guys ask out girl. That's his assumption. Okay, and the reason that they're not doing it is not because the world has changed. Is because what's his assumption? Not because they're lazy. No, it's not because guys are lazy. Worse than that.
Like women don't demand it.
Yes, women are allowing the guys, quote unquote, to get away with not being, acting in a honorable fashion. So, they pull up to the house, honk on the door, honk until they come on out, text them, I'm here, or what other stuff. And basically, and since the women are responding to that, so therefore there's no motivation for them to change their behavior. Okay? Okay, so that's the... Can you give me a glass of water? Thank you. Let's just analyze that for a moment. Do you think his theory is true? Anybody want to weigh in on that?
I think you can go either way, honestly.
Go ahead.
There are guys, there are girls that will ask out guys. And guys that will be very happy for that to happen.
Yep.
And then there are, there's the traditional way where a girl feels like they are being too forward. Okay, so like that girl asked that question because she thought that even though that she had the hunch that he was interested, she felt like if she was going to be too forward, then that will scare the guy away. You know,
right.
I actually think that's a pretty classic argument.
Right. And if it's going to be too aggressive, then she's going to lose the prospect. Right.
Right. Which I don't necessarily agree with that. But that is a very prominent thought amongst many.
Okay, I understand that. All right. Now. Okay, let's keep on going. Question number two. How does a woman in the video feel about not getting asked by her man friends? What's her interpretation of it? How does she feel about that?
She's disappointed.
She's disappointed, and before his advice, she's interpreting it as what? Not being desirable, that she's being rejected.
Friend zone.
Right. She's stuck in the friend zone. Right, not a place the one person wants to be. Okay, so now, yes.
I'm not sure I understood what is needed. Anomaly and behavior.
That's a good question. So I don't know if everybody heard Adrian's question. The question is, Why has the model basically fallen apart where women can be in these sort of like nebulous friend relationships where the guys aren't really, as they say in Yiddish, making the move, asking the people out in a straightforward sense? What's happening here? Anybody have any? I mean, we're all not sociologists, but we all have to guess. All right, Adrian with a theory. Go ahead, Adrian. Blind demand, go ahead.
You're at a party, you're at someone's home, but in today's day and age, there's apps where there's thousands people that are ready to go out.
Okay.
Whereas before, if you got lucky and you're in the right place at the right time, you might have found someone here.
Okay, so Adrian's theory is that by virtue of that, we have all these apps, JSwipe and Hinge and Bumble and Schmumble and all the stuff, as a guy who's been married 29 years does not really know about, but I've been told, basically created a surplus of getting a date in a certain sense is relatively accessible because there are these electronic mechanisms that will curate people for you. Now, they may not be the best people for you, but whatever, it adds a greater versus in the old days. You had to go to MJE, you had to be at the Kiddush at the right time. A lot of things had to work out in the perfect situation for a person to say, hey, would you like to go out, et cetera. So it's a theory. Anybody else want to weigh in on that? Okay.
Well, when was this change detected? Like, in my mind, maybe it's a birth control pill or women's liberation movement era. When free love started happening all over. I don't know when the actual change happened, so I guess it depends.
All right, so we're talking, there's a lot, okay, there's a lot, what you're talking about is birth control and the sexual revolution that changed relationships in America profoundly. That's for sure true. But we're now talking about the fact that you can have, that this woman is feeling is that guys are not asking out in a normal way, which is a sort of a weird situation. So here's the question is, how would most people react to having to ask out a man? What do you think? Most people would do it, don't do it, intimidating, non-intimidating, would do it, kind of do it, have done it, always don't do it. What do you think? Obviously, yeah, it'll be here.
Done it.
Okay.
It doesn't usually work out well, but I've done it.
Stephanie, thank you for sharing. All right. So...
No, I agree. I've done it. The times when you have to do it, I think there's just not sufficient interest. If a man is interested, he will let you know.
Oh, so you're saying you're really arguing that woman whose guys are coming over to ask to do watch Netflix and chill, they're not substantially interested in a relationship. They're just want to keep it in the friend zone. If they're really interested in a relationship.
No, they're not interested. Friend zone. Do you know what Netflix and chill actually means?
probably the chill part probably means have sexual
relationships. It's not a friend zone, but it's not a relationship
zone.
It's
a friends with benefits zone.
You gotta bypass it.
Hold on, so Chloe, it's a friends with benefits zone.
Exactly. Look at you. So woke.
I think if the guy is interested, then the girl can do no wrong. So if she asks him out, wonderful. If he was never interested in the first place, it's not going to do anything.
All right. So you really, as far as
the
initiation factor is, it plays at ultimately not a significant point.
So I think it's up to him. If he was interested in the first place, maybe he was nervous, whatever, and there's a reason not to ask, and then the girl asks, wonderful, then he'll appreciate that. If he was never interested in the first place and still isn't interested, then he says,
no.
No.
Yes. All right. That's a reasonable assumption. That seems a very good take. So we bring this up. Why do we bring this up? Because in we are coming up quickly to the book to Shavuot. We read the book of Ruth, and there is a very interesting midnight experience in the third that happens in the third chapter of the book of Ruth, which we're going to learn together, which is. We're not talking 2021, rather, but we're talking in the time of the Tanakh. So we're going to now look at that for a moment and see a rather unconventional asking out, a serious asking out. Here we go. Okay. All right, so let me have somebody read. All right, so Anna, can you read?
Where am I start? Oh,
From the beginning of the Naomi, her mother-in-law said to her.
Okay. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "Daughter, I must seek a home for you where you may be happy. Now there is our kinsman, Boaz, whose girls you were close to. He will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor tonight. So bathe, anoint yourself, dress up, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not disclose yourself to the man until he has finished eating and drinking."
Okay, stop right there. Okay, so let me just get, for those who are not intimately up on your the Book of Ruth, let me just bring you up to date. Let me give you the Sparks Note introduction. Here we go. Very quickly. We have the main character is Naomi. She was married and her two sons. There was a famine. They went to Moab. Her husband and her two sons died. And she brought back one of her non-Jewish daughter-in-laws, which was Ruth. Unclear if she converted before or at that time when she came back to Beit Lechem. Unclear from the text, etc. There's a dispute among the Mephorshim. And since they're now without a husband and they have the family property, in the second chapter, basically, Ruth said, "Hey, should I go to gather in the fields?" And we learned from the Parshiot that part of the agricultural safety net that every Jew has to do is leave a corner of the field. And shicha, that if you reap a section of wheat or barley, if one or two strands fall to the ground, that has to be left on the ground so the poor person can gather that. So in chapter two, where did Ruth happen to chance upon? The field of Boaz, who is a distant relative to Naomi, okay? She goes there and she gets there and Boaz welcomes her in and she gathers tons of food that's able to support her and her mother-in-law, and the time goes on. And so now Naomi, who feels very bad that, you know, relatively young daughter-in-law, who's a almana, who's a widow from her son, is living there, and she says, "You should be happy." I.e., it's a nice way of saying, "You should be happy, you daughter. I seek a home for you where you may be happy." I.e., I would like you to get married. All right. So at this point, you would expect her to say, "And you're a young woman, and you're, you know, I think that reasonably attractive." I don't think the McGill says that she was amazingly attractive like the other Imaot, but a good woman, and you'd expect her to do a shirach date or whatever dating they did in the time of the shoftim, in the time of the judges. I don't know how it was, an array, whatever it was, but she doesn't do that. She says, our relative Boaz, who you were hanging out by the girls who are gathering the grain, is going to be in the granary tonight. And I want you to bathe, get all dressed up, basically dressed up for a date, and go down to the threshing floor. And then do it covertly. After he's dinner, and here's the key thing. So keep on going there, Anna. All right?
When he lies down, note the place where he lies down and go over and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what you are to do. She replied, "I will do everything you tell me."
Okay, this is bizarre, okay? So the trick is like this. Why is he in the threshing floor? Anybody know? This is an advanced Mikhail question. Why is he hanging out in the threshing floor in the middle of the night? Doesn't he have a bedroom? Okay. Anybody figure that out? The practical reason. Why is
to watch over it?
Exactly. Basically, he's had his entire year crops in the grain silo. And what does he not want to have happen? Thieves to come in the middle of the night and steal all the stuff. Okay? That would be like losing your entire salary in one night. That would be bad. So therefore, where is he going to be camping out? He's going to be camping out until that grain gets processed and bagged and put away in the proper place. So when they brought the stuff into the granary, before it gets bagged and secure, he spends his night sleeping in the granary so people don't march off with his stuff. Okay. So, you see that even though he's we find out later he's a great Jew, you got to watch your stuff. You got to watch your stuff. Okay. And then what she says, wait till he eats and does what on the grain there. What does she tell him? What does she tell him to do? When's your moment? Eating and drinking, lying, and then he's going to be basically lying down on the grain and what? Falling asleep.
He'll be drunk and sleeping.
Well, he's not going to be drunk. He ate dinner and he's going to sleep, and he's going to have some sort of like. Apparently, this was like a known thing. I don't know how Naomi knew this, but apparently that was like the practice was that basically the nights when you have all your grain in, you spend the night in the barn or the granary, and you have some sort of like sleeping bag or whatever was necessary. I mean, it's June in Israel, so you don't need that much of a cover because it's not probably pretty hot in Beit Lechem. And then she to go there and do what? She tells him to do what?
Uncover his feet.
Uncover his feet, lie down, okay? And now obviously, and then he'll tell you what to do. So what can you infer from that? What is she really doing?
She's asking him out.
Okay, so politely. She's asking him out. Now, we're going to see what's going on. Now, all right, so let's see. So Ruth, this is very unconventional. Okay, so we'll see. So question is, are they going to be sleeping together? We got to find out. All right, we now stay tuned here. All right, let's get Anna, keep on going. Oops, sorry about that.
So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had instructed her. Boaz ate and drank and in a cheerful mood went to lie down beside the grain pile. Then she went over stealthily and uncovered his feet and lay down.
Okay.
In the middle of the night, the man gave a start and pulled back. There was a woman lying at his feet.
Okay, that doesn't happen all the time. Okay, especially you're sleeping in the granary. You want to sleep, and lo and behold, there's this woman at your feet. Well, she's there lying there. She's not gathering grain. Okay, and. Okay, so he asked the obvious question. Go on.
Who are you? He asked, and she replied, I am your handmaid, Ruth. Spread your robe over your handmaid, for you are a redeeming kinsman.
Now notice, did Naomi tell her to say this line?
No.
Naomi said, saying that you just uncover, and basically you're supposed to make, who's supposed to make the move?
Yes.
Boaz is supposed to make the move. What is Ruth doing? Ruth is making the move. Okay? So the Megillah is, at least in certain circumstances, is not agreeing with Steve Harvey. There is a time where the woman has to make the move. Okay? Not every time, maybe not in a normal time, but the bottom line is, her sense of the situation that she felt that he had to make the move here. And what was essentially in that short words, I am your handmaid, Ruth, spread your robe over your handmaid, for you are a redeeming kinsman. Compacting that very cryptic phrase, what essentially was she telling him to do? Act like a mensch, but what specifically is acting like a mensch mean?
Is he like offering to like kind of put her under his protection? Like he's putting his coat on her?
Yes. So the word redeemer or the Hebrew word is to be the goel. So you need to know in the Parsha of Bahar, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, there is idea of in Judaism, we are a capitalist system, but with many social service safety nets, okay? One of the safety nets was as follows. Let's say you become so impoverished that you need to sell your ancestral land in the land of Israel. Okay, so that means you never do that unless you are destitute. Even in that case, what is the goel? That your relatives have to be goel. You have to redeem you. How they redeem you? They buy the land. They give you the money, let's say $500,000, whatever, $100,000, and they give you the land back. So that's what a relative has to do. Charity begins at home. You got to help out your family. Your family's down and out. The mitzvah is you got to help them out. You can't let them fall down. You're the guarantor. You are the safety net of your family, minimalistically. Okay. Now, well, you see, there's a hierarchy. Who has the obligation? But she adds a little additional rider to that package. She's only talking about the field. What else is she suggesting is going to be part of the ancestral land? Come on, guys. In addition to redeeming the field, what is she really suggesting he should do?
Marry her.
Exactly. Let's see how he reacts. So that's it. Now, forget about it. There's one thing is to ask somebody out on a date. Okay? But to ask somebody to marry you, you know, when they've not known each other that long, that's pretty bold. Okay? We're not talking to asking on a, asking for a first date for a cup of coffee. Let's get together for a drink. How about a little dinner? Let's get married. Okay. All right. So let's see how did Boaz handle that? Let's keep on going. Anna, Bavakasha.
He exclaimed, "Be blessed of the Lord, daughter. Your latest deed of loyalty is greater than the first in that you have not turned to younger men, whether poor or rich."
Okay, stop right there. All right, keep on going. Yeah, a little more.
"And now, daughter, have no fear. I will do in your behalf whatever you ask, for all the elders of my town know what a fine woman you are."
Right, the Hebrew is Eshet Chayil. Okay, so that's she's the Eshet Chayil. All right. Now, what does he say? What is his answer? Did he say, yes, I'll be the redeemer, and we'll get married? As Melissa pointed out, she got the maybe, but not maybe as a blow off, but he's taken her request in a very serious way, okay? So first of all, why does he say your latest deed of loyalty is greater than the first? What is he telling? What deeds is he referencing?
To Naomi, what she did with Naomi?
Number one is she has scored and has been taking care of her elderly mother-in-law. Okay, she could have been back living in Moab. According to the Midrash, she was a princess. She could have lived a life of luxury, but she was committed to becoming a Jew, or she was a Jew. She wanted to live as a Jew, and even if it meant living with a sad, depressed, lonely widow who has no and has no real means of support. Which means that she's going to have to be begging for support. So she went all out. And he says, this is even greater. Why is this a greater gesture of loyalty? Go deeper, guys. Why is this a greater act of loyalty?
Because she could be with younger men.
Exactly. She has options. Boaz, as you see from the text, is not a young man. I mean, he's not in a wheelchair, but he's part of the town elders. He's at least middle aged from the text. One theory puts him as old as 91. All right, but the key thing, he's very spry. I mean, so I don't know, he's young 91. It's not clear from the text, but clearly he has, he's been married before. He's 50s, 60s, you know, from the, you see he's running his fields. He's inactive, but but a middle-aged guy. And she's probably like, I don't know, 35, 40, 35. Well, she has a kid. I don't, you know, she's in that 30 zone. She doesn't have to marry a 60-year-old dude. That's, you know. So basically, she's giving up a large chunk of her romantic life. I mean, I'm not saying that old guys are not good, but she could do better. From the romantic standpoint, Ruth can do a whole lot better. And he says in the fact that you've not turned to younger men, whether poor or rich, or even being with a younger guy who's not so wealthy, but you'll still have a good life. Go with albeit wealthy, but an older guy. He's saying that was not, that's a big, and why is she doing this? Because that will mean the support of her and Naomi and the perpetuation of the family legacy. Okay. All right. Let's go on. Keep on going, Anna.
But while it is true I am a redeeming kinsman, there is another redeemer closer than I. Stay for the night, then in the morning, if he will act as a redeemer, good, let him redeem. But if he does not want to act as a redeemer for you, I will do so myself as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning.
Okay. So, and then I keep on going, next sentence.
So she lay at his feet until dawn. She rose before one person could distinguish another, for he thought, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor.
Okay, so one thing at a time here. So he agreed that he is in fact a Goel, but what is that? What's his argument back to her? Or what's his counteraction to her? What's his reason for not saying yes?
There's another Goel, or another redeemer.
Who's a closer relative, who's a closer degree relative than I am, you know saying? All right, and he basically has to have right of first refusal. In other words, who has to help out the family goes in order of the closeness. Obviously, if to your brother, your sister, you're close, or your parents, either between your parents and you, you gotta be the Goel. But your third cousin will have other people who are closer. You know what I'm saying? All right. And now why does the Megillah say very carefully, she slay at his feet until dawn? What do they want to make sure clearly is not being insinuated, which of course was the initial possibility? Did she not do in the threshing floor?
They did not have intimate relations.
Exactly. And why did she get up and leave the threshing floor before like dawn, like very early on? What was she trying to do? What was the reason? Why'd she leave so early from the place?
So that no one would see her and assume that she did have those relations.
Right. So she wanted, in order that not to give her a bad reputation or give him a bad reputation, that's probably that he's sleeping around with women. Okay. Okay, Rabbi, go on.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
You can. If not now, when? Here we go.
If there is a closer relative, I guess, A, did Naomi know? And if Naomi did know, then why would she send Ruth to Boaz and not the other relative?
That is an excellent question. And we're gonna find out the answer shortly in the text. But that's an excellent question. Okay? Let's keep on going. Anna, you're the reader tonight. That's it. You're done. Anna, I do you freeze? All right. Maybe she's not. All right. Dan Lastman from Oakland, California. Keep on going. And he said, take it from him. And he said,
hold out the shawl you're wearing. She held it while he measured out 6 measures of barley and he put it on her back. When she got back to town, she came to her mother-in-law who asked, what is it with you, daughter? So she told her all that the man had done for her. And she added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying to me, do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. And Naomi said, stay here, daughter, till you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today.
Okay. Now, so basically, just to go on to chapter 4, for those who are familiar with the Megillah story, Who is the person in the, who is the closer relative name? Famous name in Tanakh. Get extra credit if you know this. Who
doesn't
is
name, right?
Say it again.
He doesn't have a name. It's that name that's not a name.
It's the name that is not a name. Plony Almoni, which is basically a call like Joe Smith. The Tanakh does not out the guy who basically says no. Okay. And it implies that he's willing to do the field part of the redemption, which means the financial part, but he wasn't interested in adding an additional wife to his family because that was apparently going to cause some shalom bias friction. Honey, you'll never believe what happened to me at work. Okay? You know that guy? Anyways, keep on going. All right, and then, of course, in chapter 4, Boaz redeems the field, marries Ruth. They have a child, okay? And it's raised by Naomi. And ultimately, and that child becomes the descendant of which critical figure in the Tanakh?
King David.
King David. So first of all, this shows, it elevates the idea of that we see that the person who is a convert is elevated because the king of the Davidic dynasty, grandmother, who was called an Eshet Chayil, was a convert. So just off the bat, you see there. Now, going back to our initial focus of dating. So to do this is a really gutsy move here. You know, on the level of rejection, let's give an alternate chapter 3, okay? Ruth decides, okay, Naomi, I'm going to go down to the granary, and I'm going to do this play. And then what could have Boaz's reaction have been? Let's take it the other way. Let's play it out. What could have been the alternate unpleasant DVD ending?
He could have said, you know, how dare you insult my honor coming here and making a proposition.
What the heck are you doing? Because that's crazy, you know? It's a crazy move. I mean, you know, why couldn't they have a conversation like in the middle of the day and say, you know, Boaz, can I have you for 5 minutes? You know, the old, you know, poke the head into the office, say, you got a minute to chat? How come she didn't do that, you know? This is crazy. Come into the middle of the night, uncover the feet, you know, and cover your robe over me. I mean, it's like, you know, the drama. It could have gone really bad. It could have gone really bad. So I want to share with you, I think this is an opportunity for us to share, but I think this is helpful in our relationships that we have in general. Frequently in our relationship life, that could be with our parents, with our siblings, with our spouses, with our significant others, in our dating, oftentimes, as far as in the school of thought called cognitive behavioral therapy, the Jewish and quite traditional Aaron Beck, Tim Beck among his friends, identified that basically what makes people have difficulties or maximize the difficulties of life is what they call cognitive distortions. So I'm going to go through and I'm going to apply it to the case. The number one cognitive distortion is all or nothing thinking, okay? All or nothing thinking. Either, you know, if we're going back to the dating situation, okay? Either he's gonna ask me out or nothing, okay? A girl meets a guy, she likes him, she thinks that he likes him. Either he's gonna ask me out or that's it. You know what I mean? All or nothing, okay? Without recognizing, as Anna pointed out, you know, sometimes, that very narrow, I'm only gonna do it in this particular way, is a limiting thought. And maybe in this situation, it might be helpful, because as Anna said, because if he'll say no, would have said no anyway, then you got nothing to lose. But people are all or nothing. They can only, either they're gonna be this specific format or not. And if it's anywhere else, they can't function, okay? So Ruth was not concerned, because even if he would have said, I'm not interested, or had a very negative thing. Okay, she tried. So what's going to happen? She is already living with her mother-in-law, and you know, basically being supported by gathering gleaning. Her situation is not ideal, so she will try to address her circumstance in another way. But sometimes you all or nothing approach. Either it's going to be this way, or nothing is a killer. And that's true for all our decisions. Yes.
How do you deal with that? How buoyant can you be our attachment? It's got to be now.
Yes.
Is that an absolute now? Or is there something to do even if it's assertive?
Yes.
In terms of flipping?
Yes. And first of all, there's a rule, by the way. As you guys know professionally, I'm a fundraiser. So most of my requests, the answer is no. Okay? Because nobody bats 1,000. So the rule is no means no now. But it may not be in 5 minutes or in a week or a month or a year. Okay? And maybe Ruth would have got a big no. It's not over. You didn't die. There's another round. There's another inning. There's another opportunity. That's one approach. Second approach, some will, some won't. So what? Someone's waiting. SW to the fourth. So the bottom line is this all or nothing, either is going to go exactly this way or not, is a killer. Let's go overgeneralization, okay? You know, let's say a woman would say, guys need to be in the driver's seat, and if it's not, he's asking it out, it'll never work. Okay, that's an overgeneralization. Where's your data? That might, I don't know if that's true. And maybe, you know, and why, you know, that maybe this might be the exception to the rule. I'm just saying that Ruth took the opportunity. This was, she knew this was not the normal way, but she didn't overgeneralize like, well, this is not how it's done. This is not how people get married in our society. We're not going to do this. Don't overgeneralize, okay? People overgeneralize. It's always like that. No, okay? I'm not saying act stupid. I'm saying, but making the wrong logical inference can sabotage your success, okay? We go to number three, mental filters. Mental filters is a very good one. People, this goes in both directions. Either you have a friend and you are narrowly just notice all their good qualities and you filter out all their negative qualities. Or conversely, you see all their negative qualities and you ignore their good qualities. You have a mental filter and therefore that comes to harden your assessment of the person without being real, without realistically, look, everybody has good qualities. Everybody has bad qualities. It's a mix. Some, God willing, that the person has more. But if the question is, do I have a mental filter that I am having confirmation bias or some sort of bias that either that I want to look at the person in an overly rosy fashion or I want to see the person in an overly negative fashion? But this mental filter, without saying, look, we just talked about in the Parsha class, Lashon Hara, classic situation. You see a circumstance where a person did something wrong and immediately, you share, and a person shares that story, a damning story about a person says something negative, it really, one of the injustices of Lashon Hara is that you are judging the totality of the person by one experiences. Have you, all of us, not had a bad day? Have we all not done things that we are not proud of? Does that mean that we're all bad people? No. But the bottom line is that, Lashon Hara, it's taking a very small sliver of the person and saying, this is the person. That's not just. You have to be like a Kaddish Baruch. You have to say, be Merachim. You have to, Dam Kav Schus. You have to understand. I'm not saying ignore reality. I'm saying because we have mental filters that we screen out either positively or negatively. Okay. So similarly, in the dating situation, you know, she could have looked at Boaz, oh, he'll never do that, or, you know, whatever. It would have made it allowed her not to be creative. Here's another one. anybody have a friend who's like always negative all the time? Does anybody have the negative Nancy friend? They might know such people that just, they're just like, they can always find the negative in everything. If you know that, you know, okay.
Negative affect.
What?
Negative affects. Why bad news sells.
Right. Exactly. So, and therefore, and then when, so even when good news comes in, they'll start saying, no, it's not so good. Blah, blah, blah. And then, there's a catch, there are strings attached, it's not going to work, you know? So, and that's a personality trait, but I'm not saying to overblow the positive, conversely, not to discount the positive, okay? It becomes a distorting thing. So you just have to know, one of the things that they do in cognitive behavioral therapy is to, the person's on a diet, and the person says, I can't diet. I saw the delicious chocolate chip cookie right out of the oven. I just had to have it, and I just grabbed it. I can't diet. So the therapist says, one second, Timmy. Were you successful today? Did you, tell me about your breakfast. I had a bowl of fruit. Did you have any sugar cereals? No. Did you have any cake with the coffee? No. So you had an under 300 calorie breakfast. That was very good, Penny. Why are you discounting that? How about snacks? What'd you have for snacks? Well, I had some rice cakes, a little bit of peanut butter. Did you have a Twinkie? Did you have any cakes and cookies? Did you have ice cream? No. What'd you have for, tell me about your lunch, Penny. Oh, I had, what did you have for lunch? Did you have two slices of pizza with a half a falafel? No. I had a bowl of salad with some dry tuna fish with some low-cal dressing on top of it. Well, that's fantastic. So you're discounting all that positivity of a positive life change, and you just discount the fact that you had that one, you're discounting the positive because you had that setback, okay? No, but I'm just, but I like to make it real. But that's what I would tell myself, okay? And then it's jumping to conclusions. We're all guilty of that. We're all guilty of that, okay? That we make a certain assumptions about people. This is big in dating. I was at the MG Kiddish. I saw we used to say good Shabbos, but the way he said good Shabbos, it was a little bit of a mean good Shabbos. He's not really into me. I'll never work. I'm not coming here again. I'll never meet anybody. Don't jump in. Okay. He's terrible. Okay. Meanwhile, most people's emotional world has nothing to do with you. It's their own head, it's their own stuff. Okay? That's very important. The key point, the lesson here, as we got another 6 minutes left, is a time for boldness. Okay? Ruth recognized that she's in a very bad situation. Now, she could have had an easy, what he comments is, she could have, what would have been the easiest thing for Ruth to do? What's she about that home? What's one option? What's her second option? Okay, she can be a prostitute. Okay, but it seems that she's an anxious child. That's not what she's doing. There's a normal, better option on the table here. What she compliments her for not doing. What should she have done? Right, try to find a young, single man in the community to get married to. Good-looking woman, why not? Great person. Everybody knows she's an Ashes Kyle. She's got a good reputation. She's a humble person, hardworking. She's great. That would have been it. But what would have happened if that? Who would have got the short end of that stick? Basically, she would have left her mother-in-law. Okay, bye-bye. Good luck. The door hit you too hard and took it away. So basically, she didn't want to abandon her mother-in-law. And who her mother-in-law was essentially her teacher. It was because of the role model who Naomi was is why she wanted to follow her. So she didn't want to abandon her. So she had to be bold. All right, so I did a translation of the Ralbag. The Ralbag, let's have somebody read. Let me have Shana. Take us home here, Shana. 4 minutes left. Let's go.
The Ralbag 13th benefit of the Book of Ruth. This episode teaches us that if a person can attain a wonderful benefit through an activity which is somewhat brazen, they should not lose the good opportunity because of the embarrassment that they will feel by doing this unconventional activity. They should, however, try to lessen the brazenness however possible. You find that Ruth did not resist implementing Naomi's plan to sleep at the feet of Boaz. She entered the gainer covertly so no man would detect her presence. She stayed at his feet and she entered the granary covertly so no man would detect her presence. She stayed at his feet and fully awake through the night as a way to prevent promiscuousness. This is demonstrated by when Boaz asked, "Who are you?" She answered with wisdom and intelligence and not as one who had just woken up.
That's it. Basically, not only was she had a plan, but she was like ready for action. She was ready for action. She was ready for action whenever he's going to wake up. And she had the right thing to say. And she worked out her line, and she did it with confidence, also in a manner of also some sort of like not hope, but not confidence without being aggressive, with a humility. She had the right touch to be able to present her case in an elegant way, and it really worked. And basically, that, you know, that changed Jewish history essentially. So the take home for all of us is that in life, there are certain opportunities that you have to seize the day, and you have to be bold. And if it's a tremendous opportunity, and even if it might be that you have to risk being rejected or embarrassed, sometimes the woman has to ask out the man, and sometimes the woman has to ask to get married. Not the normal case, but it does happen. It's a, you know, this is the anomalous case. Okay, so, and again, I'm not. I agree in part with Steve Harvey's point that there is, you know, certain guys act in a immature manner because they've been allowed to get away with that. And there is a person could be assertive. Look, that's not how I'm going to have the relationship, and be willing to walk away if the person wants to be a baby, because you really want to be with that such a person. And most likely, as Steve Harvey said, which I do agree with, if the guy really wants you, he will. He will rise to the occasion to, as they say, to man up, to be the man that he should be. Okay, so that's an important principle. So this, what we see from our heroine of Tanakh, Ruth, she's a heroine because she was a, she's the quintessential Ger Tzedek, a righteous convert. So that's on where our focus tonight. Two is that she had an opportunity, very unconventional. She made all the moves. She didn't get an automatic yes either. You know, it wasn't like she did the move and suddenly yes. Then there was a whole move. Then there was a whole negotiation, you know? And she saw the process through and she came out. And it shows that for her, let's just look at the big picture. Why is Ruth great? Part of Ruth is great is that she would have rather be with Boaz, who the Midrash says was one of the Shoftim, one of the great Jews. And raise a child together, who would be and have a home with that guy, albeit he's older, versus a younger guy who will have less character. So she gave up a measure of the romantic capacity, the enjoyment, for the benefit of having a home and be able to continue the legacy of her first husband, help out her mother-in-law, and become ultimately what she did not know, but be ultimately the grandmother of King David. Okay, so there's a time for boldness, and the things that hold us back oftentimes are all in our own head, our own thinking about that. We fall into certain cognitive distortions or cognitive traps, black and white thinking, overgeneralization, mental filters, all the things that we discussed, and being, aware of that, or get it if you feel that opportunities are passing by, to go to a therapist to help you to show you to be successful. Because it's okay if you to maximize your success to get expert opinion. Person had to want to buy a house, they wouldn't say, "Well, a I'm looking to buy the house.
If you want to come to the town, yeah, I'm doing that now.
What do you do?
So the bottom line is that there's a time to ask for expert opinion for a lawyer. You wouldn't necessarily you have a difficult tax situation, you wouldn't be your own accountant. And if you have personal issues, you would get some time to ask for expert opinion is a wise thing. You certainly wouldn't do your own surgery. You would go to a doctor if you need a physical help. So if a person wants to be successful psychologically or be successful in whether it be a coach or a therapist, it makes the most sense, okay? And y'all can feel embarrassed. I just want to, promote that. So that takes us to 9:17. We have Rabbi Wilds who's walking on all right, so you're taking over.
No, so I was leaving because I finished. I figured I'd do my class at home, but then I realized maybe this.